Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we talk about what we should be both concerned and hopeful about our changing climate with our guest, Bill Weir. He's the chief climate correspondent for CNN, former host and executive producer for the CNN original series, The Wonder List with Bill Weir. Bill's also the author of the new book. It's a dandy. It's titled Life as We Know It Can Be, kind of can be in parentheses, published in April. And the subtitle is Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Milwaukee native, early in his career, Bill spent a few years in Wisconsin as a sports anchor at WLUK-TV in Green Bay. So he's got lots of experience with Wisconsin as well as the rest of the world. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in as we visit about climate. What about climate change worries you? Have you maybe even asked the young people in your life what they're worried about as far as the future is concerned? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bill Weir, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Are you kidding me, Larry? It is so great to be with you. I love Wisconsin so much, everything about it. And I'm thrilled to spend some time with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a dandy book. And the book started, I think, Earth Day 2020, something like that. You started writing letters to your son?
Yeah, exactly. So I became a new old dad in the spring of 2020. My daughter, Olivia, who inspired me, inspired much of my life, as our kids tend to do. When I looked at, Olivia and I have the same birthday in 2003. And I think when she was 11, I looked at her and realized she was going to turn my age in the year 2050. And it gave me this idea for the Wonder List where I said, I want to go to the wonders of the world and wonder what will be left of them when she's my age. And greatest green light of my life. I got to just truly see the world, Larry, change my perspective on so much. And then, my new partner, we didn't think we could become parents. She very much wanted to become a mom. Olivia's stepmom now. And so when little River came along, my son, at the height of the pandemic, I'm holding this squirming little bundle and realizing this kid could live to see the 22nd century. And so much was happening in the first weeks of his life nationally with the pandemic. And I covered the George Floyd fallouts. And so I started writing these sort of letters of apology, you know, sorry, welcome to the party. We're really glad you're here. Sorry, we broke the sea and the sky. But I'm going to look for, as Mr. Rogers taught me, I'm going to look for the helpers when things get scary. And so I set out to sort of just write a practical guide, like where should he live? What kind of house should he build? And in the end, I ended up actually with more wonder than worry.
Yeah, with more wonder than worry. And the book, I loved how you organized this book. I mean, you start out with Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Which, what do we got on the base? We've got physiological needs, then we've got the safety, then we've got love, then we've got esteem, and then right at the top of the pyramid is self-actualization. How did you land on that?
Well, Larry, I started just with the basic, like, how did we get ourselves into this mess? You know, I was raised, my dad was a Milwaukee, smartest high school dropout I ever knew. I loved history and geology, and he made me fall in love with nature, you know, and hiking in the Wisconsin Dells or splashing in Silver Lake in Washera County. But he would always say, well, it's just a matter, enjoy this while it's here. It's just a matter of time before somebody puts a golf course there, you know? And so he filled me with equal parts sort of wonder for natural world, but also worry about human nature and how we can lose things and if we're not careful. And so when I thought, what caused the problem? It's really our wants and needs as 8 billion humans. And if you start talking about human motivation, you end up with the OG, you know, godfather of humanism, Abraham Maslow, who wrote this theory in 1943. He'd come up with this come from a horrible childhood. His mother was horrible to him. And he became obsessed with the most mentally healthy in society. And he figured if we just understand each other's needs and fill them up, then we can be the best that we're meant to be and get along and live in a world of peace. He was a real idealist. And I realized that, wow, you know, I took the bottom of my pyramid for granted when I was a kid growing up. I never thought about the quality of the water in Silver Lake or where our food came from, how it was grown, or the cost of our energy choices. I didn't. And now my kids don't have the luxury of not considering that stuff. Yeah. And I argue that if we connect with each other around the bottom of the pyramid, around air and water and bracing for hotter temperatures and growing our food in the most sustainable ways, we will fill our love and esteem needs in ways that, you know, social media and shopping sprees just can't do.
Oh, man. Well, let's talk about air for a minute. You talk about in that chapter about the carbon Godzilla, and you talk about a guy, Marty Odlin, I think it is.
Yes, name was. Yeah. Yeah, this guy's he's a fisherman scientist who grew up on the docks of Maine. He's fourth generation. All he wanted to do was sort of chase cod and mackerel in the Gulf like his forebears. And he went to study at Dartmouth and Columbia and came back and realized the Gulf of Maine had heated up four times faster than the rest of the planet. And most of the fishing stocks were gone. He did the math. It just didn't make sense to get a lease in a boat. So he started an ocean repair company trying to pull carbon out of the sea and the sky using oyster beds and kelp rafts. And we're talking about my frustration with how we talk about this story. You know, it's the worst when it comes to a planetary existential crisis. It's the worst branding in history. You know, global warming, warmth, people like warmth. And nobody's afraid of the greenhouse. People, we like greenhouses. You know, we grow tomatoes and flowers. And he said, it's a Godzilla. It's a carbon Godzilla. And that clicked for me, like this light bulb moment that humanity, through our brilliance, we've unlocked all of this, you know, dinosaur juice from the earth. And at first, it helped us do the heavy lifting. It built the modern world. It expanded our lifespans. But the carbon monster in the sky got so big, it's now 1.5 trillion tons. He says, you know, it's destroying our fish and melting our snow and ruining our farms and making everything that's great about life, you know, harder. We should get angry and go kill that thing, chop it up and bury it down and stop making it bigger. And that just sort of crystallized the debate, you know, like every day, how can we make carbon Godzilla a little less bigger in our choices? How can we urge people to help us chop it down? What are the new ideas on chopping carbon Godzilla and burying it back from whence he came? Because until we do that and even out the number, you know, parts per million in the atmosphere, you know, this is just the warmest summer in the Northern Hemisphere in 2,000 years, but it's also one of the coolest of the rest of our lives at the current rates. And we have to brace for what's coming.
Yeah, we do indeed. Well, his idea, I think it was his idea, was, and you mentioned these thousands of buoys.
Yeah. Yeah, he's betting on, he looked at a bunch of different technologies. You have direct air capture, which are machines that suck it out of the sky, right? And again, Larry, you think about it like, yeah, it's a gas. We can't see it. We can't smell it. But the idea that we have to move billions of tons of it, and these are, you know, corporations and scientists and the government all agree on, academics agree on this. First, there must be, you know, we have to stop making him bigger in the first place and electrify and end the era of fossil fuels, fuels that burn. We've been burning stuff just because it was abundant and cheap, whether it was trees or dung or whales or kerosene. But now for the first time in human history, the two cheapest forms of energy are solar plus storage and onshore wind. That's why Texas leads the nation in clean energy. But we have to think in these new terms, but also we have to draw down a lot of this in order to undo some of the damage. And that means shipyards and trains and guys in hard hats and you know, steel-toed boots, moving mass and figuring out a way to get it underground. Some people are taking farm waste and turning it into bio oil and injecting it back into old salt mines or oil wells. You know, some people say we should just bury our human waste and where the methane doesn't release. And by that way, you're controlling lots of ways to tackle this. But he bet on seaweed. Kelp has the ability to pull down carbon at a rate, you know, four times faster than trees. And so he designed these rafts that are made of waste material wood and kelp seeds and limestone, which acts as sort of Tums for the ocean, because the other big problem with all this carbon Godzilla is it's changing the acidity, the pH levels in the ocean. And so if you could take 2.5 Mount Fijis of limestone and sprinkle it in the ocean, like at the top surface, some think it would even that out like a giant Tums. So these rafts would do that. And as the kelp grows into this microforest, once it gets heavy enough, it cuts itself and would sink to the bottom of the ocean, where that carbon would be locked away for a couple hundred years. We don't know if this works at scale. You know, it's one idea. He's also using oyster beds, which draw it down and holds the carbon in their shells and then creates a protein source, an income source for coastal communities. But it's kind of cool that he's trying, and he's getting lots of investment, a lot of scientific backing to see if this works. And while he was doing research off the coast of Iceland, they figured out a way to hook up the data coming, because you got to measure this stuff and beam it into the cloud in like 5-foot seas, you know? And so we're in the cusp of an industrial revolution, Larry, that most people can't even comprehend. And trillions of dollars are going to pour into ideas like these in industries that we haven't even been talking about yet.
Yeah, and I love all of the stories and examples that you include in your book about the host of all of these needs that we have. You make some really cool points that I didn't know. There are so many times in the book I didn't know that. You were talking about temperature, and you say in your lifetime, the Earth has lost a 15-foot deep block of ice the size of the U.S.
Yes. Yeah, it's hard to imagine, right? So Earth has been cycling through hot and cold for 4.5 billion years, you know, and basing on the wobble of our rotation, you know, if it shifts us a little bit more, it can start more, you know, warmer ages and it shift away, and these billion year life, you know, time scales have turned the thermostat on Earth up and down over time. But what we've done as one species in a blink of Earth time is staggering, you know. So 4.5 billion is too much to wrap our heads around. That's too big of a number. But my dad taught me this trick is, if you scale it down to the lifespan of a 45-year-old, say a 45-year-old house.
Yeah.
Right? In a 4.5 billion, 45-year-old house. The Himalayas were installed 5 years ago. Yeah. Human beings showed up 3 months ago, and the Industrial Revolution 60 seconds ago. And in that time, we've managed to melt a block of ice, you know, like you say, the size of the continental United States, 15 feet thick. And we've also pumped enough groundwater and without replacement to fill our thirsty crops, feed our livestock and all of that, to shift the gravity, to shift the position of the North Pole, because the centrifugal force is changing as we alter ice and water on the planet. The poles are melting at such staggering rates. Paleoclimatologists, I'm telling you, when you really sit down with them, the cameras will stop rolling. Man, they're really worried. They're really worried because it's happening so much faster than they even predicted 5 years ago.
Bill Weir, our guest today, his book, Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Questions for him or comments, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Joel Patnod, our producer today. Jeff Robbins, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about global and local climate challenges with our guest, Bill Weir, who is the author of Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Great to have him along. And again, join in 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. I love reading the stories of the people that are trying to deal with each of these areas You know, when it comes to temperature, and Kelly Wanzer comes to mind as an
yep.
Here's a person who's trying to do something.
Yeah, Kelly is a really impressive woman. She was an executive in Silicon Valley in sort of systems management, and she says she had a conversation with a climate scientist who told her that the odds of sort of a total collapse were unstoppable, where they say the boreal forests and the tundra up way up in the Arctic melts and releases sort of methane bombs, which makes things worse, and Antarctica and a big glacier goes in, which then makes things worse. We're in the single digits, but not a small single digit. And that was enough for her to completely change her life, quit her job, move to Washington, and start a company called Silver Linings, or not a company, but an NGO, think tank sort of lobbying group called Silver Linings, to get CEOs and lawmakers and others to think about atmospheric solar radiation management. They call it sort of climate repair, short-term climate repair. And this idea has been floating around for decades. It's the real science started in the 90s, back when I was actually probably covering the Brett Favre Packers. And I think it was 93 when Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And the ash and the soot from that was enough up in the stratosphere to shade the Earth and cool it a full degree for like a year and a half, something like that. And so scientists have wondered, could we create some sort of sunscreen in the sky to buy ourselves time to slow down the warming so the rest of the world could adapt to what's coming? And different ideas have been floated, everything from spraying basically salt spray to diamonds in the sky and different natural things, and how they would float in all of this is, there's no science on this. And there's no real fleet of aircraft that can do this. A lot of people worry that rogue billionaire is just going to start plotting out the sun on his own and how that would, set off different kinds of monsoon patterns rather. So there's a lot of resistance to this idea. In fact, when Harvard tried to float a balloon over Sweden, I believe, way up in the Arctic, and just sprayed, less particulate matter than you would just taking a drive in your car. And the resistance from environmental groups and indigenous folks was so much, they eventually shut the whole thing down. Mexico outlawed it after some guy started selling cooling credits and launching balloons with this stuff. Anyway, her argument is that we should at least explore the possibility. It's one of those case of emergency break glass ideas. And I'll be honest, Larry, when I first heard about this 8 years ago, people were like, that's nuts. Now it was like the main topic of conversation at the conference of the American Geophysical Union. So we're there. We're really smart people are talking about sunscreen in the sky.
You know, we have a history, albeit not the greatest, of actually doing something. And you point that out when you just talked about the Montreal Protocol.
Right. Yeah. That's probably the most successful example of international environmental treaty. The chlorofluorocarbon CFCs that we used to use in our air conditioning and cooling units and all of that. I think 190 countries signed on to the Montreal Protocol to phase out these chemicals that were just punching a hole in the ozone layer. I still remember, we were talking about our worries about the ozone layer, acid rain, more cataracts as the more powerful, spectrum of sunlight gets through. The ozone protects us from so much evil flying around in our galaxy there. And it worked. It worked. But what's interesting, and the ozone hole is healing. It also might have bought us some time on terms and prevented more warming as sort of a side effect of this. But what's interesting about that treaty is the United States was totally in favor of it because our manufacturing base would have profited more. They already had the technology to come up with the replacement for those chemicals. And so the Chamber of Commerce and the lobbies were all for it. Now, getting all these countries to agree on something this sort of controversial extreme would be so difficult because there's not much of a profit motive. You know, who pays for this? How do you orchestrate it between countries? If you fly these sorties, you could use rockets, you could use different things. You have to do it constantly, or else it's like opening an oven door and the heat will just come back. And who knows how this affects the ocean. So again, it's one of those things where James Hansen actually, who warned Congress, one of the original climate scientists who says this is real, he said at least has to be considered. While other scientists like Michael Mann at Penn State say, no, we still have so much work we can do right here and avoid the worst warming.
You know, Peggy in Chippewa Falls has a comment that kind of relates to this, I think. Let's go there. Peggy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just am, I'm sorry, I'm turning so I can park here. Yeah. I'm just concerned about why climate change has become a political issue. And when did that start? You know, why are the Republicans denying that there is, and generalize, I'm just generalizing there. Why are they saying that there is no such thing as climate change, where the Democrats hopefully realize that, yes, it is real and it's destroying our Earth for our children? And I also just heard on the news the other day that DeSantis has instated a law that is none of the weather people can talk about climate change. And how can that be? I'm just perplexed here.
Good questions, Peggy. On the last part, the law in Florida that the governor, he basically stripped out the language around climate change and took it away as a priority of how they plan and permit. There's no prohibition, but a weather, probably what you saw was there's a meteorologist, Steve McLaughlin, I believe is his name, who went on the air and said, this is ridiculous. We are living through, like, Florida may be the most vulnerable state to climate change in the union, between hurricanes, algae blooms, sea level rise, all of those things. And to not make it part of the conversation as we plan our futures, you know, he was making a statement on that. That's what made news there as well. It's really fascinating because this is, you know, the Republican Party is the party of Teddy Roosevelt. The words conservative and conservation are just a few letters apart, and was the case up until George H.W. Bush signed the first global climate pact in Rio de Janeiro. And if you remember, some people even remember a PSA with Nancy Pelosi and Newt Gingrich sitting on a couch in front of the Capitol saying the one thing we can agree on is coming together around climate. But you know, the storyline changed in the Republican Party because it's the most profitable companies in human history. Their entire business model is now at risk. And for the longest time, they denied it was happening. But this is the subject of dozens of lawsuits, cities, states, tribes suing big oil companies, big polluters, basically for hiding the side effects and knowing about it for a generation. And there's internal memos from Exxon and a whole evidence trail that is now working its way through the courts to decide, should they have to then pay for this? But yes, the at this point to deny, it was one thing to say, well, maybe we can't do anything about it, or maybe we can't slow down our economy. More people would suffer if we do that. You can make those points. But to argue it is not happening at this point is just delusional. And I think the more especially the younger generation understands this, and I'm about to write an op-ed, actually, calling on every weatherman in every market in the country and local newsrooms, because I work my way up from Austin, Minnesota, through Green Bay. I worked in Chicago and L.A. newsrooms, imploring my old newsrooms and my old colleagues who are there and have a moral responsibility to put context on these unnatural events and say, here's what growing season used to look like. Here's where it is now. Here's what the scientists say. You don't have to take a stance. You don't have to make it political. but at least put these unnatural events into context for folks so they can understand what's really happening and it's not just a run of bad luck.
It's kind of a whipsaw. And, you know, you wrote to your son, River, that we're going to probably whipsaw between progress, setback, inspiration, despair.
Yeah.
And do you worry that environmental roller coaster is going to frustrate your son's generation?
I think so. I mean, if you think about it, I know we don't like to think about the COVID pandemic, but it's a little sort of 3-4 year microcosm of human nature, both the wondrous potential and also the mistakes and that whipsaw that we ride on, right? When my little boy was, I saw him on an ultrasound. He was the size of a kiwi. If you could have typed COVID-19 into Google, he'd have gotten zero results. By the time he could open kitchen cabinets, you know, billions of people around the world had masked up and changed their habits, and every big lab in the world was working on testing and a cure. And, you know, and so, but we also made a ton of mistakes, I think, in that time, because there was so much disruption and fear and people were lost, and we need to honor their memories. And so that's kind of like the ride I imagine going forward. There's going to be incredible breakthroughs in clean energy systems and maybe carbon removal and who knows what else. But I think we're going to have to go on this ride. Right now, there's the EV market is slowing down. So you're seeing headlines about, you know, and I bet if you went back and read papers a century ago where there was the same kind of daily trickle of stories, is the horse making a comeback? Has Henry Ford, you know, reached market saturation? Like, but at a certain point, you know, it just becomes part of history. And the shift now in terms of a new electrified future, and it goes so far beyond that. It goes into communities really connecting with each other and with the ecosystems they live in, and understanding them in ways that modern life, you know, makes all of that optional. And outside is outside. What happens outside is the most important. And more time we spend out there with each other, seeing the changes, talking about solutions, the less pain we'll feel, and certainly our kids will.
Yeah. Don in Iron River has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hey, hi. I grew up in Madison, and I've been coming up to the Brule River since 1978 for fishing. And I built my cabin in 2002, and it was very, very, very cold in August, way back when. And now I got by with a dehumidifier. And 10 years ago, I had to put an air conditioner in.
It's crazy.
Yeah, crazy.
Isn't it amazing?
You do talk
That's
about...
That's the thing.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead, please.
No, you go ahead, Bill.
No, I just, I hear that sort of thing, and that's kind of my beat. I'm so gifted that I work for a place that believes in this story, even before I was on the climate beat, but just let me wander and talk to folks. And the thing I really leaned into, especially with the Wonderlist, is change. What have you seen change in your life? And if, you know, you don't believe it, talk to the fishermen, the anglers, the sportsmen and women, the bird hunters in my home state of Wisconsin, and they'll tell you. And then you have to go through, you know, I use, in addition to Abraham Maslow in this book, I draw on the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who invented hospice care and gave us the five stages of grief. And, you know, she was practicing medicine at a time in the late 60s when 90% of doctors in a big Chicago hospital wouldn't tell cancer patients that they were terminal. But when they did, she wanted to understand what they were going through. And the five stages are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And folks are going through those stages in their hometowns, you know, not having left, missing the way your caller described, a cold August. I mean, imagine what's Door County like without Fall Fest and ice festivals, and what does that mean to the wildlife? And what and all of that is, it's a big thing to process through. So it's easy to stick in denial. And But the sooner we can kind of understand, here's what's happening, here's the trend, here's what we can do about it, and get into a level of not acceptance doesn't necessarily mean surrender, but at least it means, okay, I'm working on a planet with a new set of physical rules, and the old fishing seasons and everything, you know, past is no longer prologue. And it breaks me that my grandpa's Silver Lake in Washera County near Watoma is not the one that my little boy River will see. It's rough.
Yeah. Mary in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Well, hi. Love your show. Thank you to the guest. And I have the book on my wish list already. And my question is, what are your opinions about the e-car, because we bought one last year. We try to be more and more efficient in, you know, using less, and we have a compost pile and all of that. But then we read, you know, several things about, you know, the battery, which needs to be replaced like every 10 years, and how much that battery uses with the 3 tons of nickel ore and 12 tons of copper.
Sure.
And the mining of the lithium, et cetera. You're probably familiar with most of that. Can I get your opinion on that, please?
Absolutely. It's a great question, Mary. A lot of people are, you know, kicking these tires for the first time, and especially if you want to do the right thing. But miles to miles, there's no comparison. And just in terms of, I think I've seen, if you drive it over the life of your car, by the time you hit maybe a year and a half in or 15,000 miles, from that mile onward, your car will be a positive, you know, is much better than it would have been. Whereas if the length of your gasoline powered car, it's sort of the way, you know, we can talk about the cost of building wind turbines, you know, the physical structures, the steel and all of that. But over the lifespan, it is so much more better for the ecology. It's better for the climate situation. The thing also about EVs is that at a certain point, there will be enough recyclable material. So the minerals that in batteries can be used again and again and again, as opposed to, you know, a ton of carbon fuel based fuel. You burn it, it's gone, right? And the beauty of electrifying everything, and this is why 90% of the new power plants that are coming online and are now permitted coming up are renewable energy, solar or wind power right now, is that once you build a solar farm or a wind farm, the energy delivers itself to you. You don't have to go chasing it under mountains and oceans and piping it across continents. And so as the, you know, the charging source for your EV gets cleaner, your choice to make to drive that way just gets cleaner over time. Same with your house if you go with an induction stove. And so much can be done in that space too. I write about shelter and how much waste is sort of built into our lives when we don't even know it. Just by stripping it out, we make so much of a better change. But the EVs market now is in the middle of a tug of war with China. They've figured out a way to build really cheap EVs. They've got one that's $10,000 model, and that's why the tariffs just kicked in. Joe Biden is trying to stop that and give the domestic EV industry a time to beef up. The big companies right now are sort of softening. It's sort of like they saw a huge demand and they put too much in the pipeline and there wasn't enough uptake right then, but that might even out over time. The companies that are EV only are growing and taking more of the market share away from the traditional automakers. So again, this is sort of like my COVID and the vaccine analogy. Like, yeah, there's all this sort of business news that roils around as this entire new industry explodes. But for people who have them and love them, you know, I've driven a bunch of them, and the charging infrastructure is coming out in new, exciting ways too. The range anxiety is going on. I rented my first EV on a trip to see my grandma, you know, my stepmom out in Oregon. And that was like a moment, right? Like, that's an option. Okay, let me try that. And the more people sort of taste it, the adoption will go even faster, I think.
Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned housing in your comments just now, and shelter is something you do talk about in your book. You, and by the way, we're dealing with a serious issue, but so many, you've had so many experiences that you write about in the book that are so funny. But you talk about working as a young guy for a Saudi prince building right. his home, and then you kind of compare that to Norman Klebold and his net yeah. zero community.
Yeah, so this was one of those amazing, I've been sort of Forrest Gumping my way through life, Larry, you know, like riding this feather. My dad, who was a cop with the Milwaukee Police Department, and then just kind of had a midlife, like, I'm out of here. He was wanted to be a mountain man. So he quit everything and moved out to Colorado and lived sort of in a little funky trailer park just down valley from Aspen, the ski resort there. And so I spent my summers and Christmases with him. My folks split up early and my mom sort of took me around the country on a sort of gypsy existence, but I'd spend my summers with my dad in the outdoors. And he was a detective when he quit the PD, but he ended up getting a job in the nail room at a lumber yard in Aspen and worked his way up to sort of a salesman to contractors and got me in as a carpenter's apprentice and a laborer working in the summers, which was awesome, you know, building houses under the Colorado sky. And the houses were just insane, man. You know, they got bigger and bigger. And then Prince Bandar Al Saud, this is one of the princes of Saudi Arabia. He was the ambassador to the United States at the time, really good friends with the Bush family. He loved to ski and shop. And so he would come and hang out for a couple weeks and stay in the hotel. And then he decided to build a house. And he built a 55,000 square foot home in Starwood above Aspen. It was bigger than the Pitkin County Airport at the time. And I worked on that house. But also when it was finished, he hired a bunch of the guys on the crew to be his drivers. And I ended up sort of chauffeuring these three Saudi security guards around. And at the time in the 80s, you know, this was like, wow, this is living. This is peak existence. Look at this. Look at he had his favorite English pub from London dismantled and reassembled in this house in Aspen, you know, just over the top opulence. And my dad was always get depressed when I tell him about that stuff. And I didn't think about it until, you know, much later. And I'm back in Colorado to visit the first net zero community, which people had built sort of in a direct resistance to Saudi oil dominance and just waste. And there was an idea that came out of the oil embargoes of the 70s when my first memory was waiting in gas lines with my dad in Milwaukee. At that time, there was a team at the University of Illinois said, what if we could build a house for a climate like Madison's, but uses 2/3 less energy? And using early computer models, they realized, well, we do it wrong in this country. We build houses with skinny walls and giant furnaces and air conditioners when it should be the other way around. And so they proposed sort of a Pueblo style, thick, really well insulated walls with southern exposure to catch the sunlight. And, you know, with the air filtered through, much more efficient. But the United States never picked it up. Jimmy Carter lost. Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the White House. Conservation became sort of a dirty word politically. And the Germans took this idea and ran with it and developed what is now known as the passive house. And this is the first time I toured these sorts of homes, which were so well insulated. They use so little energy. You can heat the place, even in a place like Colorado, with body heat and warmth from your appliances in some cases. The filtration system, as it flushes the dirty air out, it captures the energy and uses it to heat or cool the fresh air as it comes in. And it was just inspiring to see that. And now I'm a dad. I nerd out over stuff like insulation, R numbers, and all of that. And just how the story in my mind had shifted from when I was a kid to that the 55,000 square foot home was the dream. When I realize now how much wasteful that is, where now I hope my kid thinks that a really well built passive house is the dream, you know? And yeah. And there you go.
And more of those are being built now, thankfully, in the U.S. Our guest today, Bill Weir. Bill Weir's book is titled Life as We Know It Can Be. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Talking today with Bill Weir, author of Life as We Know It Can Be, as stories of people, climate, and hope in a changing world. You can join in too. Number to call 800 642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. You visited blue zones.
Yes.
Places where people live longer and healthier lives. How do they do it?
Well, it is an interesting thing. I went to this, I've now been to a couple of the blue zones. My friend Dan Buettner, he's a National Geographic fellow who would stage these sort of global expeditions as a young man and stumbled across the fact that Okinawa, Japan had a much higher rate of longevity than anywhere else. He had women there living, sort of the longest living women in the world. Well, you know, at a rate much higher than the West. He thought, that's an interesting mystery. And so they'd look with demographers and physicians and try to figure out pockets of these sort of longevity hotspots, and they'd circle them with blue ink, and I became known as the Blue Zones. And I did these stories with Dan at ABC News, my first one, went to Ikaria, Greece, this rocky little island where people lived at like 4 to 100 at a rate 4 times greater, not just to the U.S., but even some other islands in Greece. And there was something about that island. And you go there thinking it's going to be a silver bullet, some sort of reverse trawl or whatever. But you realize it's a buckshot of a bunch of different factors. That it's a lot of it's the Mediterranean diet, a lot of beans and veggies. They do eat meat, but it's a special occasion kind of treat. And there's natural movement throughout the day, very hilly. There is real cross-generational reverence. And so you go to a party at 2 a.m, you got 10-year-olds and 85-year-olds hanging out together. The elders are childcare, their sense of purpose laid into your life. It's the social bond is so strong. It's the kind of place where if you miss church, somebody's going to knock on your door to check on you. It's the kind of place where if you have to hand your baby to somebody because of an emergency, you got a dozen choices. And I started, you know, keeping track of these ingredients for sort of the healthiest, happiest, most sustainable communities in the world, and tried to, you know, bring them back. They have a honey there that they eat every morning with a big spoonful. It tastes like, looks like peanut butter, and tastes like gin. It's because the bees pollinate this pine, and to them it's like natural Viagra, but it coats the digestive tract. It's an anti-inflammatory, and like any, you know, if you're using honey from pollinators, if wherever you live in Wild Rose, Wisconsin, or wherever you are, that helps your immune system as well. There's some science behind that. But what I realized, Larry, is that the places that I admired, and I also went to Vanuatu in the South Pacific, which is always at the top of the happiest countries list, went to Denmark, which is usually number one, and to a place, the things they have in common is their trust and connection with each other, and their natural surroundings, and their seasons, their ecosystems, their air, their water, the bottoms of their pyramids. They are as much a value to them as any kind of status, and that's how they fill their love and esteem needs.
It's a fascinating story. Dave and Toma, will give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Say, one of the things, the problem is kind of the mindset he was portraying earlier. He was talking about building new efficient houses. Something we can do right now is study how to rehab the houses, the housing stock we have. We can't really, I don't think we have the resources to build an efficient house for everybody. And we should be studying ways to rehab the houses we have without having to gut them and basically rebuild them. That would go a long ways towards solving things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I totally agree, Dave. That's a great point. I get into that as well. My chapter on the passive houses talks very much about, not only does the National Association of Realtors and others say we need to build 5 million new homes to keep up with just the demand of population, but we have to rehab, you know, countless tens of millions that were built before the Reagan administration, just as you say. And there are companies, there's a whole innovative sort of green tech building thing that's happening with that very problem. A company called Energy Spring or Energy Sproing is in Dutch, is a company in the Netherlands that means leapfrog in Dutch. And they figured out a way to make panels that you put on the outside of your existing construction that's basically like a tea cozy for the whole house. And the challenge they've had with American homes is that we don't have the same sort of uniform construction taste as they do in some places else. And so, you know, doing it around a colonial or some, you know, an Art Deco may be different challenges for the builders. But there's also ideas that if you have an energy audit, and there's ways you can, there's now something that was invented by a professor just in his garage that's basically like fix-a-flat for your house. You spray an aerosol that seals every crack, even up to, you know, half inch big, a whole half inch big. It's a natural material, non-toxic, and would tighten up your existing home in ways that would save you really tangible money off your heating bills. But here again is what I threw out 4, 5, 6 ideas in the book of people who are doing stuff, mostly to get people excited about the next idea, because this is like, again, there are future billionaires walking around who are thinking about just that. How do we rehab homes and make them passive or passive-ish, even though they were built a long time ago?
Yeah. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You write that about 200 million to maybe a billion people will be uprooted by an unnatural disaster in their lifetime, and at least 13 million people will migrate from the coastal communities of the U.S. as the seas rise. And you talk about where's the best place to go, and, you know, Canada, maybe Wisconsin, Buffalo, sure. New York came to mind. But I like the concept you talked about. There's all the resistance. There's this NIMBY kind of thing. And actually, there's some of that going on, being written about right now by the Wisconsin State Journal regarding Madison. But there's also YIMBY.
Right. Yeah, the original NIMBYs were, at least when I remember them growing up as a Gen Xer, were environmentalists trying to stop, you know, big nuclear power plants or developments. So not in my backyard became their rallying cry. These days, it is more likely to be used by affluent, relatively affluent white Americans trying to stop either more dense housing in their neighborhood or a wind or solar project. And social scientists have gone back and looked at, you know, the average wind, group that opposes, say, a wind turbine development somewhere is 16. And that's not 16%, 16 people who have the time and motivation to show up at every meeting and do everything they can to stop this clean energy project that's coming in. And that doesn't mean every idea is perfect for every place. And unfortunately, we've kicked this can down the road so long, Larry, there are no easy decisions anymore. I love desert tortoises, but if the desert tortoise, you know, keeps gigawatts of solar power from being installed in the American West or something, these are conversations we have to figure out. And so much of the clean energy future and where people will migrate to, where new industries will pop up, will be based on NIMBYs versus YIMBYs. Yes, in my backyard. And I look at YIMBY examples in the book that comes from really surprising places. As I said, Texas is a model at building out clean energy and building transmission lines to carry it. The rest of the other parts of the grid, so the U.S. grid is divided into three big pieces: East Coast, West Coast, and Texas. And Lone Star fashion has their own energy pretty much for 90% of the state. But because the economics are so cheap for wind and sun now, and because they have a lot of YIMBYs, libertarians, who don't like government red tape and say, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of people living there, let's run a transmission line now, it's building out faster in places like that. And then we'll attract more industry because they're figuring out ways to take all that free energy. Literally, it is free in the middle of the day. There's so much sun and wind in California and Texas. But now you just have to store it. And so with thermal batteries, which are basically big, hot rocks in a box that can hold enough heat to make steel or run a factory, that will attract a whole new industrial belt to these windy places. And so the NIMBYs
yes
and the YIMBYs,
in my backyard.
Something to keep an eye on.
Not in my backyard. Bill Weir, thank you so much for being with us today. I love how you ended the book to your son and daughter. Every time you help the bottom of someone else's pyramid of needs, you fill the top of your own. It's a wonderful book. I really appreciate having you with us today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Weir, our guest. Thanks, Bill. And thank you for listening in. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about how to take care of our wetlands, our floodplains, and our streams. And two expert guests for you today. We have Katie Belfus. She is the Outreach Programs Director for the Madison-based Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Katie, welcome back.
So great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you with us, and also great to have Aaron O'Brien with us as well, Policy Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Hi, Aaron.
Good morning.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Do you ever wonder why wetlands are a haven for so many critters? Is there a marshy area near you that you'd like to know some more about or have questions about? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address, talk@wpr.org. Well, we got Wisconsin, we got Wetlands Month, and May is American Wetlands Month, Katie.
Indeed, it's a fabulous time of year to celebrate wetlands. Of course, we celebrate wetlands every month of the year. But May is a particularly great time because everything's waking up and blooming and birds are returning and insects are coming out. And maybe we don't love all of those insects, but they're fabulous for those birds to feed on. So it's a great time to celebrate Wetlands Month here in Wisconsin.
So how is your organization marking the occasion?
We are doing a lot of things. We have... We're continuing some of the things that we do all the time, including our Wetland Coffee Break webinar series, which is a free bi-weekly program where you can hop on a Zoom call with us and learn from lots of people around the state about wetlands. We have a special free postcard giveaway so that you can send postcards to your loved ones that have beautiful wetland photos on there. We're promoting our story maps, which are some really cool online tools that help you explore wetlands from the comfort of your own home, maybe during a storm like last night where you can't get outside, and explore and learn more about where we have wetlands in Wisconsin and what kinds of wetlands we have. We are also holding an event next week on Tuesday, May 28th at Delta Beer Lab here in Madison to celebrate wetlands. So come on out and enjoy from 4 to 8 p.m. free.
Lots going on. And you encourage supporters to... email lawmakers, maybe thank them for, and Aaron, let's turn to you for that, for the policies to help restore and preserve wetlands.
Yeah, that's right. That's another thing we're trying to do as part of American Wetlands Month. We've had some really nice things happening in our capital where we're starting to see a lot of support from our policymakers from both sides of the aisle. I'm happy to say, thinking about the role of wetlands with respect to flooding and water quality and some of the other problems we're trying to solve in the state. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of those today. But so we're just inviting our members and other friends to thank our legislators for recognizing the importance of wetlands and the role that they play in helping make sure our wetlands are happy and healthy and meeting our community's needs.
What kind of state policies are involved that relate to wetlands?
Well, there's a lot, and it depends on what you're interested in doing. So
yeah.
The thing that we've had in Wisconsin for a very, very long time, in fact, we've been a leader in the nation, is what we would call strong wetland protection laws. So these are regulations. They're modeled a lot after the Federal Clean Water Act, and they're designed to make sure that when land use activities such as development and agriculture and other uses happen, that they're done in a way that's as sensitive as possible to our water resources, including wetlands, so that we can have both healthy waters and economic development. So those are things like permits, right? Regulations mm-hmm. that require permits for development. More recently, our organization has been working very hard to enable more policies that encourage and provide support and incentives for wetland restoration. And the reason this is so important is because something like 75% of the wetlands in the state are privately owned. And so if we would like to see more wetlands being restored to the landscape, and you have to remember we've lost 5 million acres of wetlands,
yeah.
almost half of what we had historically, we need to make sure that that's something that is easy for, or easier for private landowners and communities to do. So we've been working on looking at, say, how wetland restoration projects are regulated, because you still have to get a permit when you want to do a project to restore wetlands, and also what supports are available to help communities that are looking to restore wetlands to solve problems.
So lots going on there. Tim in New Berlin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I've always wanted to go canoe Horicon. Do they let you do that? I know that it's part state, part national, but can you just take a canoe into Horicon and fish? And if so, do you know of an outfitter do you know anything about if you can do that?
I don't know of any outfitters per se, but they have a couple of really great visitor centers associated. There's a state visitor center and a federal one as well. And those folks there would know all of that. And I'm sure they have a website that you can hop on or give them a call to get that kind of information. You can paddle there, and there's various put-in locations. But, check there first for that detail.
Yeah, but you can
it's a great place.
Drop a canoe in, and it is a great place to canoe. I haven't done it for a while.
It's also a great place to look at birds. Yeah. If you like water birds,
yeah, for sure.
Waterfowl.
For sure.
And Tim, if you're over there, stop in the visitor center, because it's a cool place as well.
They have great exhibits. Yeah, it's a wonderful place.
Is that our largest marsh?
It is, wetland? And it's one of our, it is recognized a lot of the times as one of the largest marshes in this region. It's also one of our six wetlands of international importance that are here in Wisconsin. These are wetlands that have been recognized as globally important, and we have six of them here. Horicon was the first one, the upper Mississippi River floodplain marshes, the Caucagan and Bad River sloughs, the Door Peninsula coastal wetlands, the Chewaukee Prairie down in southeast Wisconsin, and the lower Wisconsin State Riverway.
And so what makes them wetlands of importance?
Because they are important resources for specific species, whether that's birds, fish, or turtles, or other things, mussels even in this case. The lower Wisconsin Riverway is a really important corridor for a particular kind of rare mussel. Or because they have habitats and community types that are rare within their area or globally rare. And there's a very extensive process that a site has to go through when they nominate themselves for this designation to check all the boxes and provide all of the data and make sure that it's a robust, worthy site. And we've been very proud to be involved in the designation of some of those sites.
Yeah, what kind of federal support is there for wetland protection? I mean, in addition to the what we just talked about here.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit, maybe even more in the restoration arena than in protection. So we have a number of federal agencies, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is part of the United States Department of Agriculture, has programs where farmers can receive cost share payments and technical support from conservation engineers to design projects on their property, some of which might be designed to support water quality and soil conservation objectives. Others may be more focused on habitat. So there's things like the Wetlands Reserve Enhancement Program or the Environmental Quality Incentives Programs. You can get very lost quickly in the acronym soup. But then there's also Fish and Wildlife Service at the federal level that has quite a few programs for habitat restoration. And the other thing that's really interesting lately, and it's actually pretty exciting, is that there is a growing recognition of the opportunity to use nature-based solutions for things like climate resilience and climate adaptation. So we're seeing a lot of federal policies that are creating, and they're coming out more in the form of executive orders where the agencies are being told and directed to figure out how to integrate nature-based solutions into their programs. So even like FEMA policy, for instance, and helping with post-disaster recovery or pre-disaster projects, they're trying to figure out how to fund and support the use of things like wetland and floodplain restoration as part of these programs. I'd say we're not quite really fully operational yet in the country on those things, but there's a lot of momentum, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned permits earlier, Aaron. What does, say somebody wants to develop or build a house or whatever it might be, the permitting process needs to be rigorous? I would think.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so Wisconsin is very lucky in that we do have fairly robust state level protections to ensure that impacts to wetlands and other water resources are minimized in the development process. And the way that looks essentially is if a developer or other private landowner wants to do a project on their property, if there are wetlands present, they would need a permit to, they call it discharge fill material. So they'd need a permit to do some development that where there's a direct disturbance to that wetland. And as part of receiving that permit, there's a process one has to go through to identify where the wetlands are and what their boundaries are, show that they've done what they can to design the project to avoid and or minimize the impacts to that resource. And then sometimes those losses or those impacts are unavoidable. Then there's a process called mitigation where if they get permission to develop a little bit of a part of that wetland, they might have to support some work to restore some wetland elsewhere on the landscape.
And sometimes folks think of that as just this big barrier, right? That we have to, it gets in the way of some of the things that we want to do. And I always like to encourage people to think that wetlands are where they are because that's where nature has designed our landscapes to manage the water that we have on our landscapes. And you can fill a wetland, but that doesn't mean it's not the place on the landscape that the water still wants to come. And so oftentimes when you look to filling a wetland or doing a development project on a wetland, you potentially could run into problems down the road. The wet basements, leaky things, erosion, various things that you don't want to deal with as a property owner. And so figuring out a way to do the project that doesn't impact the wetland is, in the long term, in your best interest and probably the communities, because those wetlands also provide the natural benefits to your communities as well.
And creating a new wetland.
Yeah. Mother Nature took a very long time to create the wetlands that we have. And the science on restoration is improving every year. But there's still fundamentally some things that we humans can't make and can't fix. And there's certain types of wetlands that are easier to restore than other types of wetlands. Because let's talk about fens. Fens exist on our landscape where there's very special water coming up from the groundwater that's very alkaline, mineral rich. And there's certain plants that grow there. And you can't create that. You know, that's a place, that's just a natural thing that happens where the groundwater is upwelling through the base level rock. We can't restore that. We can probably improve the health of an area that was a fen historically and has been degraded, but there's only so much we can do to create some of these communities. So really protecting the ones that we have left is what's really important.
Yeah, you can't just say, well, I guess I'll go out and build a new fen.
Right. And I think what Aaron is talking about, the important, you know, protection is very important. We need to maintain the half of our wetlands that we still have. That's vitally important. But it's not enough if we're to address some of the challenges we face. It's not enough to just protect the wetlands we have remaining. We need to figure out where were there wetlands on the landscape that have been drained or otherwise disturbed so that they're no longer functioning as wetlands, and how can we restore them to wetland functionality to provide those services and natural benefits that our communities rely on. So holding the line with protection is not enough. We have to look at restoring, and that's just the reality if we want to address our challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. Taking a look at our Wisconsin wetlands today with our two guests from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, Katie Belfus and Aaron O'Brien. Join in with your questions and comments. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Looking at our Wisconsin wetlands on the program now with our guests from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, Katie Belfus and Aaron O'Brien. Great to have both of them with us. And again, you can call in. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. So just off the top, how are other states doing, or how well do other states protect wetlands maybe compared to us?
It really varies. I'm proud to say on behalf of our state that we've always been a leader and continue to be a leader. So in Wisconsin's the in the top three, if not the strongest in the nation in terms of how we care for our wetlands. We also happen to have a lot more wetlands than a lot of other states. Think about some of the arid states in the Southwest or Western United States, and they just don't have as many wetlands on the landscape. So we're doing pretty good. There's a lot of states that rely heavily on whatever the federal regulations are under the Federal Clean Water Act. And as you may know, in the last year or so, we've seen some pretty big changes to the federal protections, and it's really left some of those states in a pretty big pinch.
So there was a 2023 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that removed from federal oversight a large amount of wetlands in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Has that ruling changed state regulations over wetlands?
Yeah, so you're referring to the Sackett versus EPA decision. And what happened there was that it really narrowed the scope of protections that are available under the Clean Water Act. And the protections were what we talked about before the break, which was the need to get a permit if you would like to have some development that's going to have some impacts on wetlands. And what that decision did was said that now only wetlands and water bodies with a continuous surface water connection to traditional interstate navigable waters were protected under the Clean Water Act. So that left probably 80% of our wetlands in the state, roughly 75 to 80%, not subject to federal regulations. Fortunately, we do have state-level regulations that still apply to the vast majority of those wetlands. There's a few exceptions, some exemptions that are on current state law, but for the most part, we're okay.
Paul in Chile, Wisconsin, has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you, Larry and guests?
Great. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind, Paul?
Well, we're on a chain of four lakes up in northern Wisconsin, just south of Bruce. And we've got a problem child that floated in alongside one of our docks. It's a piece of floating bog that broke itself loose, or somebody cut it loose. And we would like to kind of know if we can remove that piece so we have better access to get the docks in and out, or...
That's a challenge.
Yeah, that is a challenge.
Well, and I'll just explain what a floating bog piece might be, because it might be some of your listeners who are scratching their heads right now. And there are wetlands that can, the vegetation is so thick that it actually can float on top of water. There might be some very loose soil kinds of materials, muddy soil kinds of materials below the mat, but it actually is floating on the water, and you can stand on these things and kind of jump on up and down, and it feels a little bit like a waterbed. And when, especially in areas where we humans are artificially maintaining water levels, it can happen elsewhere as well if there's a big storm event or whatnot and the water levels go up naturally, but often it's related to a dam that might be maintaining water levels. If the water levels go too high, and you can imagine that mat sort of is up too high, it might separate from its connection to the land and then float wherever the wind pushes it. So I don't know how big this thing is, Paul, but I don't know if there's a way you could drag it somewhere else. That might be the easiest way to move it off of your dock, because I can certainly appreciate that you'd want to have access there. But I don't know that there would be a restriction from removing the material that's floating in the water.
I have to confess that Katie's looking at me as if I might know the answer, and I have not come across this question. And so I'm not, I want to be very careful, because sure, there may be legalities here that I'm not aware of, but I am not aware of what that restriction would be. You certainly couldn't go in and cut your own piece of a floating bog and drag it off. But I think you probably have a legitimate nuisance problem, and it would be an obstruction to navigation, so you probably have some recourse there. You might want to just check in with DNR to be double, triple sure safe, but I would think that this would be a problem that could easily be solved.
Yeah, I like the idea of towing it.
Yeah. Well, you might call your local county conservation office too, in case they have other connections or ideas or suggestions. There might be some people who'd be interested in those plants, for example. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Or if there's a place on your lake where you could put it, where it might be able to establish. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a great question. Very curious conundrum.
And good luck to you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. Mary in Douglas County will go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Which agencies have jurisdiction over restoring wetlands on private lands? Some towns here in northern Wisconsin think they have the ability to refuse to let the landowner do that. And my understanding is that the town has no jurisdiction. It is other agencies such as Army Corps of Engineers, and I don't know the rest. Is that correct?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really important question. So you're correct that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would have some jurisdiction if the wetland is federally regulated. And as we've already discussed here, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is the other state agency that has jurisdiction over all wetlands. But there can actually be some local authorities as well, particularly under things like zoning. So that tends to come in on a county level. But if your town has specific policies on the books that speak to land use controls, then they may also have some say in the matter. So it really depends on what laws are in place locally.
So what does Mary do in this situation? She goes and looks up the town.
Well, I think
rules?
part of the issue is that sometimes we don't all use the same words and we don't all have the same definitions in our heads for what the same words are and what the impact of what we're looking at is. We've talked with folks who say, I really want to put in a pond. And when you talk to them, what they actually want is a wetland. And so I just say that as an example of make sure, I didn't see if you can invite your town over and show them what you want to do on your property in terms of restoration, and maybe invite someone from your DNR water management specialist to come along too, because sometimes it's hard to do that explanation over the phone or in a letter or an email where you can have a conversation on the ground. And so making sure that everybody understands what's happening. Certainly there might be limitations in terms of wanting, you know, backing up water and what that might do to your neighbors. And obviously there could be some concern there, but there's ways to do engineering to figure that stuff out so that you don't have adverse impacts. So conversation is a great place to start.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Sort of along those lines, Annie, maybe from a different direction, Annie emailed to say a neighbor of theirs has been filling in a little swamp that borders Annie's property. Annie says she contacted the DNR about this during the pandemic, but was told the DNR at that time was shorthanded, couldn't really likely respond. Is there anyone else who can help, or should she try the DNR again?
The DNR would certainly be the right place to start again, unless it's a wetland that also is now, you know, one of those small number of wetlands that are also subject to federal jurisdiction. And then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers could help. The other suggestion I would make would be to call the County Land Conservation Department, because they may have some policies on the book, either through zoning or planning. And they're also going to be probably easier to reach because they're local and working right there in your community. And they might be able to help you navigate a little more about who to call for what.
And by the way, with the amount of protection shrinking a little bit, someone else is wondering, could more development projects fill in wetlands without permits?
Not really. I mean, there have been some changes to state law in the last few years that have created some very small exemptions from permit requirements in pretty narrow circumstances, certain situations where agricultural buildings are being put in place and certain circumstances on small parcels of land with small fills. But for the most part, there is a process where a developer needs to go through a permit review, and it's working pretty well as far as we know.
Well, and because the Army Corps still does have jurisdiction over some wetlands, right? And so there still is a process where somebody has to say, is this one of those wetlands that we have federal jurisdiction over or not? So there still has to be, somebody has to look to see if it's federal or if it's state. There's not unfettered access. People can't just go start filling and nobody's paying attention.
Erica in Lake Tomahawk has a comment. Hi, Erica.
Good afternoon. I live just below the Rainbow Dam, and here's it might be 10 or 15 years ago, the DNR pulled a floating bog away from, it was trying to float, go over the dam, and that wouldn't,
There you go.
Kind of ugly.
so they did it.
So it's possible the DNR might even be in a position to move that other bog that we were
possibly
talking about.
And in that case, they were probably protecting the dam and the flow of water. So there was, you know, there was another issue at hand there. But at least we know that there's examples and it can be done. You know, there can be some dragging and towing. So
thanks, Erica.
Thanks for that.
Appreciate it very much. You can join in too. 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And we're talking about, I wanted to talk a bit more about the advantages or what wetlands provide. And I was thinking about that last night as I sat on my porch and watched the trees sway and the thunder and lightning roll and the water come down. And I was thinking about this show, actually, because wetlands provide a big boost when it comes to flood control.
Indeed, they do. And not all wetlands are the same, and not all of them provide the same kinds of natural benefits. And there are certain kinds that are, but in general, water storage is one of the natural benefits that wetlands do provide, and it's not insubstantial. And wetlands can also absorb the water and let it percolate into our groundwater, and we've seen issues where groundwater depletion is a challenge in other parts of our state. So just backing up a little bit, let's talk about what a wetland is and how you know if something is a wetland or not, because I think everybody could get behind Horicon Marsh. You got your cattails and your ducks and your open water. But wetlands come in all shapes and sizes. They can be fully wooded, but still be wetlands. They could look like a prairie, and from the road you might not even think they're wet because they just look grassy like a prairie. But you get in there and your feet are soaking wet because it's a wet prairie. There's shrubby wetlands, and so there's you know, depending on who you talk to, there's 12 or 26 different kinds of wetlands. It depends on how finely you want to dice it, right? But each of those has their own set of natural benefits that they provide. The thing that sort of defines a wetland, sort of legally, is there water at or near the surface for all or part of the year? And that's really important, right? It might be really wet this time of year and bone dry by September, but that doesn't mean it's not a wetland. So water at or near the surface for some of the year, the right kinds of soils, because the soils look different in areas that have developed in wet conditions than they do in areas that where the soils have developed in dry conditions. And then what kind of plants live there? And that is often an indicator, because some plants are built to live in places where they have wet feet for a lot of the time of the year. And so you'll know by looking at what the plants are whether you might have a wetland, even if it's dry, right? That's where, in case you could come back in the fall and look at the plant life, even though maybe the soils are, or the water is not evident, but you can know that it's a wetland. So, but vital in terms of flood protection. And when we see a loss of wetlands on the landscape, we do see an increase in erosion and downcutting in streams and flood damages downstream. And I'm going to let Aaron take it from here, because we've been working in this arena, because there are so many communities in Wisconsin that have faced huge rain events in the last decade or so. You know, up in Ashland County, they've had two enormously devastating floods where they've been repairing the same roads over and over. And so we're doing some work that Aaron can talk more about trying to help communities see where wetland restoration and wetland improvements on the landscape can help them manage water.
Yeah, Aaron?
Yeah, thank you. So one of the things that's really interesting, Larry, that is important for Wisconsin communities to know but isn't really well understood is that the condition of our wetlands upstream, right? If you think about how wetlands and watersheds function, all water flows downhill, and that tends to happen in what we call drainage basins or watersheds. The condition of those wetlands upstream can really affect what happens downstream in a flooding situation. And a lot of people think about flooding as an inundation problem, and it certainly is and can be sometimes, you know, wet basements or roads that are impassable because there's water over them. But a lot of the flood damages that our communities are seeing are coming because of erosion and road washouts and culvert washouts that are related to the movement of sediment and debris. And one of the reasons that can be such a problem for a lot of communities is because the wetlands upstream of those damage areas have also been damaged, either because there's been development, or more commonly in our rural areas, because there have just been natural processes that have happened where we've gotten ravines and gullies cutting through wetlands and draining the water and their capacity to store that water, making that go away, or streams that are disconnected from their floodplains so that when big waters come, that water can't rise out and spread out and slow down over the areas of land outside the banks. And so what we've been working on, and we've been making some really nice progress with communities in northern Wisconsin and now with policymakers, is making sure that folks recognize and understand how changes to that, we call it hydrology or degraded hydrology, how changes to wetland and stream and floodplain hydrology are contributing to flood risks and damages, and then what can they do about it, right? We can't restore everything everywhere, but where are the opportunities to put more of that capacity back on the landscape to reduce those risks and damages? And the thing that's really exciting is that our legislature is also recognizing that, and we just had signed into law in April, April 3rd, Governor Evers signed Wisconsin Act 265, 2023 Wisconsin Act 265, which creates a new pre-disaster flood resilience grant program for flood-prone Wisconsin communities, so communities that have experienced a state or federal flood declaration, a disaster declaration sometime in the last 10 years, are eligible to apply for the program. And there's going to be $2 million available for two different types of grants. The first is assessment grants, where communities can do the work needed to gather data and evaluate their problems so they can understand the root causes of flooding. And then implementation grants, and these are focused specifically on restoring wetland streams and floodplains to help reduce flood risks and damages. So we're really...
It's really good.
Yeah.
Good idea and a good program. Peter and Toma, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Well, I caught a few parts of the individual that's talking. Where is she from and her name again?
I'm sorry. Katie Belfus and Aaron O'Brien are both with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to comment a little bit about property rights. I'm the only individual that I know of that has taken a wetland case to the United States Supreme Court and succeeded with the help of Justice Scalia, who vacated and remanded our case. You know, I totally agree that we need to take and protect our environment and our wetlands for flood storage and so forth. But there's a fine line here that the wetland people are pushing in regard to property rights. The United States State Supreme Court just ran a case, and I forget the case's name. It's out of California, which basically resulted in where permit decisions, where the Army Corps or the DNR basically deny people permits to fill areas, and you know, truly it wasn't a wetland. Same as my case. My case came back and started in 1999 and finally went to the Supreme Court in 2006 and got decided in 2008. My wetlands were caused totally by the construction of a highway in front of me that blocked my water into my site. It was caused by the city of Toma putting a dam in and flooding much more water downstream where other crossings couldn't handle it. So it backed up on my property and it metamorphosed itself to make wet conditions and grow that, you know, grass that everybody wants to take and call a wetland. And, you know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate, but your point on this, Peter, is?
My point is you can't neglect property rights. People should have the right to take and have the same ability to succeed as their neighbors. And to have 400 apartments built to my north and have that hard surface water flood on me now and have a dam that is flooding 60% more than its usual capacity, you got to fix the downstream obstacles too, so that they don't put people like me in a predicament where they devalued my property to where it's worth nothing.
All right. Well, Aaron, thank you very much for calling, Peter. Aaron, comments?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that he called. And I think that you could hear in his voice and in his story that this is really sticky stuff, right? And we actually happen to agree that it is about a balance. We have to balance people's personal property rights with public interests. And somewhere in the middle, there's the right mix. But it can get hard for individuals. Now, there's two things that come to mind for me that would be interesting for Peter and other listeners to know. One is that there were some changes in Wisconsin law a few years ago, and I'm going to not be able to pull out the, I think it was 2019 Act 183, but I might have that wrong, that actually recognized the very situation that Peter's describing, which is that there are circumstances where water patterns can change on the landscape and create conditions where certain wetland characteristics develop, but in areas that weren't necessarily historically wetlands. And they are now called artificial wetlands. And in those cases, there are not state-level restrictions to the kinds of development that someone might want to do on private property. So that's law that's come into place since Peter's case, but maybe would have been invoked now because it was recognized as an issue and something that the development community and property owners really needed to have addressed. And we actually supported that law when it went into place. There was another thing that I was going to say, and it has left my mind, so I will come back to it if I have a chance.
I'll just jump in and talk broadly about the importance of communities to work together, that everything upstream affects things downstream, and that when development happens upstream, there are impacts downstream, and that we don't do a good job looking at that and assessing that and planning for that, but that we could do a better job coming together to look as communities at our watersheds and understand those dynamics a little bit better so that we are working on them a little more upfront, because it's undoubtable that there are those impacts.
And now I remember what I was going to say, which is that this is another reason why we are so focused on voluntary restoration as one of the solutions, because the wetlands are in private ownership and people do have ideas for what they wish to do for their property. And many people are interested in restoring for a variety of reasons, whether because they want the wildlife or they want to be part of solving some problem for a neighbor, et cetera. And so really thinking about what we can do to support people in meeting their objectives for their land is very important.
And Peter, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Katie Belfast and Aaron O'Brien from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, our guests today. Join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Looking at Wisconsin wetlands today with our two guests from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, Katie Belfast and Aaron O'Brien. Join in, questions at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org or talk@wpr.org. JT emailed to ask if there's a minimum size for an area to be classified as a wetland that falls under Wisconsin state regulations. Aaron.
excuse me. No, but there are sort of tiers of regulations and application of permits. So if your wetland is less than 10,000 square feet and you would like to do some activity on your land, you're able to get something called a general permit, which is basically a pretty lighter process for having the review and approval of your project.
Anne emailed to say that they're concerned about water resource management in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin. There are multiple massive sprinkler irrigation systems across the region that impact lakes and wetlands. One lake has reportedly dropped 4 feet in recent years since the system began drawing water. Anne wonders who approves such projects and how can they find out how much water is drawn and what corporate entity is taking water and for what purposes. Where should they go to get that information?
So the approval of what are called high capacity wells, which is what the emailer is referencing, is another function of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in the groundwater management program. And I believe you can probably get online and look at any given permit for a particular property and find out what their allowed withdrawals are. But it's true, there is a big issue in central Wisconsin with high capacity wells and drawdowns of wetlands, wetlands and streams. And it's an issue that's been sort of known for quite some time. And a lot of people are working really hard in a lot of different ways to address those challenges in terms of water conservation and wetland and stream restoration and other activities. So there are regulations, and then there are also some really nice activities going on to try to figure out other pathways to solve the problems.
Tom in Johnson Creek has something for us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. We had, this is probably 15, 20 years ago. They built a mall. Altogether, it was about 30 or 40 acres of buildings and asphalt, and all that water came across our place. Oh. And we went to the DNR basically said the Department of Commerce gave the permit for building it, and there was nothing they could do.
So the Commerce Department had jurisdiction on that? Katie,
I'm looking physically at it.
So.
I'm not sure either, but it does. I will say it is, whenever we put down impervious surface, that water has to go somewhere, and we have gotten better over time at trying to plan ahead of time to figure out where that water is going to go. But it's always important to think about those issues and think at a watershed scale. We've talked a lot about how wetlands help hold water on the landscape and where that happens and where water can spread out. And I guess I wanted to mention a really short little video that we have on our website called How Wetlands Manage Water that in about 4.5 minutes does a really nice job of drawing a picture and helping folks understand the relationship between upper watershed wetlands, middle watershed wetlands, lower watershed wetlands, and how that ties to groundwater, how that ties to lake water quality. So I just throw that out as a tool. It does not address Tom's question at all, but it is just a tool that we have out that folks can take a peek at to just get a better understanding of how these things are related up and down the watershed.
Earlier we mentioned, you mentioned land conservation departments. Mm-hmm. And their work. Are employees of county land conservation departments trained in wetland restoration, or to what extent are they trained in wetland restoration?
It really varies. The land conservation departments have a really big job, and the primary source of their funding comes through the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. So they're doing a lot of work with farmers, specifically focused on soil conservation and water quality improvement. We actually have a really fun and large project right now with DADCAP, our state's agricultural agency, to try to bring more training to both the DADCAP engineers as well as the county land conservation departments that they support to help folks get a better understanding of sort of these watershed concepts and how water moves across the landscape and the role of wetlands on the landscape. And eventually we'll be moving towards some training on wetland restoration and stream restoration practices. But right now we're looking to work with these groups to try to bring sort of a uniform understanding of basic hydrologic concepts, because it's not something that some of them do a lot of work. I should be clear. Some of them are very experienced and do a lot of work and a lot of great work in wetland and stream restoration. But there's other counties that do very little, if none.
So better in some places than others.
Yeah. Of course.
And all trying to do their best with the information and resources that they have available to them. And I think the great project Aaron's talking about is trying to figure out ways that we can help more of them learn about and know about these possibilities, because it just might not have come across in their training, because they might have come out from a different angle, right? And they want to do the right thing, and they want to have the right information.
And you mentioned that video, and that reminded me that you guys have a number of free webinars.
Indeed.
We talk about those.
Yeah. We started what we call the Wetland Coffee Break when we were all in lockdown in 2020 with COVID as a way to keep in touch and keep learning about wetlands while we were all stuck at home. And it's been so well received that we've continued it since then. We're in our fourth year. And those happen every other Friday morning at 10:30, about every other Friday morning. We have a calendar on our website. They're free. They last about 45 minutes. We try to keep them as a coffee break, not a lunch break, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're just a way for folks, anybody who's interested in learning more about wetlands. We've had folks talking about dragonflies. We've had folks talking about sphagnum moss. We've had folks talking about battling invasive species. I mean, there's a full gamut of there's something for everybody, I guess, as we like to say, and they're all free. And you can sign up at our website, wisconsinwetlands.org, and just look for information about the Wetland Coffee Break.
Do you save those?
They're all recorded and they are all posted online on our website and also on our Facebook page for Wisconsin Wetlands Association.
So what do you consider to be the biggest threats to our wetlands here in our state right now?
There's
too many to even mention.
Well, you know, and actually, I hope you don't mind me doing this. I really love to think about things in terms of opportunities rather than threats, because, okay. I mean, the threats are the ones that have always been there. If people don't understand what wetlands are or why they matter, it's harder to, you know, encourage folks to take care of them. But we just have so many needs in the state that wetlands can help solve: flooding, water quality, habitat decline, quality of life in our communities, you know, places to hunt, fish, and recreate. And the biggest barrier, I'd say, is that we just don't have yet enough, we don't have a big enough community of people working towards shared goals for putting wetlands back on the landscape in the ways that they're needed and in the amounts that they're needed to solve the problems that the state is otherwise investing money hands over fist to try to address. So the biggest threat or the biggest opportunity, depending on which way you look at it, is that we really need to get busy and put more and invest more heavily in wetland conservation to help address all these many needs.
Yeah.
Well said.
Tom and Stevens Point wanted to ask about the DNR approving the removal of beaver dams to improve fishing. What impact do beavers have on wetland areas?
We actually had a wetland coffee break on that last summer sometime, because there is a lot of research going into that. Historically, it's been thought that wetlands sort of harm trout habitat in particular. And I think more and more of the work is showing that that's not actually true, and that wetlands can help restore conditions that are amenable to fish and other critters. So beavers are actually sort of nature's wetland restoration technicians. They create glorious wetlands, and those wetlands can be, especially out west, so vital in fire environments where wildfires can, those areas that are wet because of beaver dams can be the source of regrowth and reestablishment after a fire comes through, because they are not burned because they are soaking wet. And so beavers are still sort of coming back from their, they had a tough row there. And, and to be fair, beavers can wreak a lot of havoc with plugging up culverts and flooding out roads and flooding out fields. And it's not to say that they are all good. We've learned how to live with them, because they're coming back in Wisconsin at a furious pace. And they can be great, great wetland restorationists and do really good things. And they can pose challenges to communities and individuals too.
And
I'd say by and large, there is a lot of evidence that beaver and trout coexist beautifully. But there's a lot of that. We need some more sort of hard Wisconsin-based research to demonstrate that, because there's a lot of discomfort with how beaver and trout might be interacting, and whether and a lack of understanding of what those dynamics actually are.
Cassandra emailed to ask if you own a private pond, would a loose floating bog be a good addition, or what are good additions to something like that?
Well, we always say the most important thing when you're talking about how to care for a wetland that you might own is really to make sure that you understand the history of your area and the history of your wetland, and what the conditions were historically before this area was settled. What's changed about those conditions, especially with how the water is moving across the landscape, and then what might you need to do on your property to try to restore as close to those historic conditions as you can, given that we're in a modern context and we're not going to get rid of roads and there's various things that we can't change. How can we sort of fake it till we make it, I guess, is a phrase. How can we work towards those historic conditions? And so understanding what was there historically is the first step before you start thinking about what should I do to enhance it. Make sure you understand what's going on around, because that will help you understand how to care for it. And I know that's a little bit of a not very satisfying answer to Cassandra, but there you go.
But we do have the handbook that provides some information on what it looks like to do that if you would like to explore a little more, if you want to say something about that.
We do. Thank you so much, Erin, for remembering my own publication. We have a little handbook called My Healthy Wetland that we wrote. It's been 10 years now, but honestly, the information in there is still as good as it was then. That helps walk you through where you can get those kinds of resources and that information. And you can visit our website, and we'd be happy to talk to you, so give us a call.
And the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, if you type that into a search engine, it's
going right to
pop up. Yep. Katie, Erin, thank you both very much for being with us today. We learned a lot, and we'll look forward to another visit.
Super. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Larry.
Katie Balfus is the Outreach Program Director for the Wetlands Association. Erin O'Brien, Policy Programs Director for the Association. Great to have them with us, and we'll get them back. And tomorrow we'll take a look at vehicle maintenance as well as restoring classic cars. That's tomorrow at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store.